Hello and welcome to World Radio, a production of HCJB World Radio, Melbourne, Australia. Now here's your host, Eric Scatterbo.
Thank you, Derek, and welcome to World Radio. On January 8, 1956, five missionaries were killed in the jungles of Ecuador. Jim Elliott, Ed McCulley, Peter Fleming, Roger Udarian, and Nate Saint. They were speared to death by members of the fierce Huarani tribe while attempting to share their faith in Jesus Christ. However, that was not the end of the story. What comes next is now the subject of a major motion picture called End of the Spear.
We have one chance to reach these people.
No one's ever made contact with these people and lived to talk about it.
Daddy loves you.
Those are scenes from the movie End of the Spear, which is largely from the perspective of the tribal people themselves, the Huarani, and from the perspective of one of the sons of the martyred missionaries, Steve Saint. Today on World Radio, we'll talk with Steve Saint about the movie and the true events that it is based on. Ralph Kurtenbach in our Quito, Ecuador office will also speak with a fellow HCJB missionary who acted in the movie and assisted in making it. So stay tuned for today's edition of World Radio as we'll focus on the movie End of the Spear. Here now is Ralph Kurtenbach with Steve Saint, son of martyred missionary Nate Saint.
Steve, you say you had a relationship with the Huarani Indians of Ecuador since you were a little boy. I want you to tell the story of how that relationship began.
Okay, well, when I was five, my mom and dad were missionaries here in Ecuador on the edge of the Amazon jungle. My dad was a pilot, a jungle pilot, servicing missionaries and Indian tribes living out in the Amazon who didn't have health care services available to them. And these missionaries were going in to give them the gospel, the good news that we have in the scriptures. These people didn't have access to that either. But there was one group of people living in an isolated area in the jungles who had never had friendly contact with anybody in the outside world. And my dad and four of his friends that he recruited felt that they should try to make a friendly contact with these people because they were being threatened by oil companies and the government here. So they did that. And in the process, my dad and four of his friends were speared to death.
And that was when you were age five. So you lost your father, Nate Saint, at the age of five, and your relationship with this tribal group began.
Yes, I call that the first chapter. In the second chapter, my aunt, my dad's older sister, who had been here in Ecuador learning the language of these people, these Huarani people, from a young girl who had fled from killings within the tribe, because they weren't only killing outsiders, they also rampantly and habitually killed amongst themselves. I've heard anthropologists say the most violent group of people that's ever been studied in history, with a homicide rate of over 60%. So this young woman that was teaching my aunt the language was reunited with two other women who fled from killings in the tribe, and then they invited together my aunt Rachel Saint and the widow of one of the other men that was killed with my dad, Elizabeth Elliott, to go back in and live with them. They did. Aunt Betty, or Elizabeth, stayed for 2 years and then went back to the U.S., where she was a very, very popular speaker, had a radio program, and has written lots of books. But my aunt stayed with the Waurani for the rest of her life, and it was in 1994 that she died of cancer, and I came down from the States to help my tribal family bury her, and then they said, now we want you to come back, or now we tell you, you bringing your family, you come back and live with us again.
Rachel Saint was working here when my wife and I arrived in Ecuador in 1992. I have met her on a couple occasions. And your mom, Marge Saint Vanderpoy, I was able to meet her one time to just connect with you on some of the main people in your story. And so do you remember much of those events of 1956 when you were a five-year-old boy? Do you remember the kind of explanations that your mom, Marge Saint Vanderpoy, or others gave you at that time?
Actually, I remember a lot more than people would normally remember from the age of five, but that's because when things that happen at age five melt into oblivion as new memories are added on. But in my case, all the events surrounding my dad's death with his four friends was something that people have recounted to me or asked me to recount to them since I was five, so it has never I've never forgotten it. So yes, I do have very vivid memories of that first really dark, really hard chapter in my life.
What about that aspect of going into the same tribal group that, in your Aunt Rachel's case, killed her brother, in your case, some years later, killed your father? How hard? What all went into the decision-making there?
Well, the question that's usually asked of me is, how did you forgive these people? That's, you know, people put themselves in my place. But, you know, the situation for me was that when I was a little boy, my dad and my mom and these other four families were all praying for the Waurani, for this tribe that didn't know any other way to live but violence. And then when my dad was killed, my mom went on praying for them, and my aunt did too, and my aunt couldn't wait for God to open the door so she could go in. So my dad died for them. My aunt risked her life for them. So when I met them, I just assumed these people are very important people in relation to us as a family. So I never felt like I needed to forgive them. That was something that I got as a heritage of forgiveness from my dad and my mom and my aunt and these other four families.
So is forgiveness possible for those of us who have somebody say something against us or do something to hurt us? Not to the magnitude of having taken our father from us, but is forgiveness possible for others as well?
Well, people want me to give a formula for forgiveness, thinking, well, you forgave the people who killed your father. But, you know, every time I go to the airport and have to go through security and they pull my baggage apart, you know, I have to deal with forgiveness there. And that is, and I wrestle with that. So I don't have a formula for forgiveness except to say that God is the author of forgiveness, having forgiven us before we asked for forgiveness. And in a supernatural way, He is able, and I've seen it in my own life, He is able not only to work reconciliation, which He sent His Son to work for us, but then it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, it says, now we are ambassadors of reconciliation. And I think what God has done with this story, you know, turning people that should be enemies, the Waurani and my family, making us one family together. Some of my dearest friends are people in the Waurani tribe. Two of the men who killed my father baptized me when I was a young man because they were spiritual leaders in my life. And now my grandchildren are named for some of the very people who killed my father, and one of my dearest friends in the whole world is the man who, I guess, finally did drive a spear through my father's head and slashed his body with a machete and threw what was left in the river to be eaten by fish and turtles.
You came here to Quito, Ecuador today to attend English Fellowship Church with the grandsons of some of the people who killed your father. Those families are, this relationship is an ongoing relationship, and your families are quite intertwined.
Yes, in fact, two of my grandchildren that were here in church with us this morning are actually named for two of the tribal people, my grandmother Dawa, my tribal grandmother Dawa, and one of the men that killed my dad, Dewey. And those are their legal names. So this, yes, now this relationship that started when they killed my dad is now in the fourth generation.
There have been books written about the situation that happened in 1956 in the jungle, the violence that took place and the five missionary men were killed. And now there is a movie as well. Would you like to describe that?
Well, actually, there's 7 years ago, a team formed to make a major motion picture of this story titled End of the Spear. But it's bigger than that. There's also a documentary film, a feature-length documentary that has been made of the same story with the intention of finally packaging the two together. So you've got this major feature-length documentary, Beyond the Gates of Splendor, that in the U.S. market, at least, is available in Blockbuster and Hollywood Video. It's also available in stores like Walmart for sale. And then there's this feature film called End of the Spear, and that is made from a book that they asked me to write about all 50 years of this story titled End of the Spear. So we've got a new book that finally, the first time, tells the whole story and all these chapters that have been written over the last 50 years, and this feature-length documentary, which is an award-winning documentary, and now this major motion picture that really is well done, shot right in the jungles and told from the Waurani's point of view.
Whose brainchild was this comprehensive package then? Is this a Steve Saint project?
No. When my son Jesse was graduating from high school, after we had been living down here in the jungles with the Waurani, the only thing that he wanted for graduation was for me to bring Grandfather Minkai to his graduation. So he was in the States, first time ever, really I guess what you'd call civilized, although civilized isn't very civilized sometimes. But Minkai was there, and I had agreed to speak to at a couple different places in the U.S., so I said, hey, let's make a road trip. So Jesse and Grandfather Minkai, another warrior from the tribe, Tementa, and I went. And then when I got ready to speak at this this big celebration that I had been asked to speak at, I thought, why am I going to speak? Minkai is here. I'll let Minkai speak and I'll translate. And he did. And there was a businessman from Oklahoma in the audience, and he heard the two of us sharing the story of how we went from violence and became family. And I think it's probably pretty obvious when we're together that we really are family and we really love each other. And this is right after Columbine, the shootings at a high school in North America and Paducah, Kentucky. And this businessman thought, you know, if our culture keeps going the way it's going, we will become like the Waurani were. And then he thought, maybe if we find out how the Waurani started walking this new trail, living happily and in peace, maybe that could influence our culture. So it was Mark Green's brainchild, this businessman from Oklahoma.
I talked with your publicist a little bit before the interview, and he said that what you told Mark Green, the Oklahoma businessman, was, if you want to tell the story, I'm not the one to ask. We need to ask the Waurani.
That's right. He came to my house, my home, to ask me for permission, but he told me that he wanted to tell it from the tribe's point of view. And I said, well, you know, people have been wanting to make this story into a movie, since I was a boy, but it takes a lot a lot of money, it takes a lot of creativity, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of connections, not only to make a movie, but then to get it distributed. And I really felt like maybe these folks had the resources necessary to do it, but I wanted to test them, so I said, and because it seemed appropriate to me, if they wanted to tell it from the Waurani point of view, it seemed only right that they should ask the Waurani, and I thought that would be the end of it. So I said, well, guys, I think you need to ask the Waurani. And they said, how would we do that? And I said, well, I know where they are, and I'll translate for you. I'll take you there if you want to ask them. And they said, okay, when are we going? So they canceled their calendars. This was a group of businessmen. And 3 weeks later, I took them down to the jungles, and they asked the Waurani, and the Waurani said no. They said, outsiders always want to come here and they want to tell what they say about us, but they never ask us what we say about ourselves. So then they said, what do you say? They asked me that. And I said, if you say no, then I too say no. But they said, why do they keep wanting to come and do this? And I said, well, I don't know about the others, but these people want to show the foreigners living in the Kawudioma, in the foreigner's place, they too are killing and angry and hating and furious all the time. And I said, they want to show how you used to live that way, but how you live happily and in peace. And then I told them the Columbine story. And as soon as I did, Minkai said, I say yes. Is it true that the foreigners too are living this way, angry and furious and being afraid all the time? And I said, yes, it's true. And they said, then you tell them that we say yes, tell our story. You tell them to show how we used to live, but then be sure to tell them how we live now, happily and in peace, walking God's trail.
That's what it's referred to in the Waurani language, is walking God's trail, to follow Jesus Christ. Is that right?
That's right. They say, Minkai says that God sending his only boy, he came here and marked a good trail with his very strong blood.
Steve, I understand that little Steve Saint is a key character in the movie as well.
Well, when they made the movie, they wanted it to be seen from the tribe's point of view, but it's hard for people in a civilized culture, in a high-tech world, to put themselves in the position of Minkayani. So they made little Steve Saint, who loved his father, who was then killed. So it, you know, movies are about relationships. So the first relationship is little Steve with his father, Nate. And then when his father is killed, and then his aunt, who he also has a relationship, goes in to live with the same people. And then he goes in to meet these people. And especially his relationship as it develops over a period of time with Minkayani, the warrior who killed his own father, and then took him in finally to teach him how to live. But the movie ends at the point of reconciliation.
We talked about you don't have a formula for forgiveness because it was just modeled for you among family members. What about fear as Aunt Rachel goes into live with the same group that killed your father? Do you recall that, or is that something the viewer of the movie End of the Spear will feel in Steve Saint, little Steve Saint?
Yes, I think that they'll see that, but you know, I don't want to say that I don't understand forgiveness. It's one of those things that can, to a certain extent, can be a result of our writing our own story and just discipline, determination, I'm going to forgive. I haven't had very good results in my life with that. What I have had is much better result, as I would explain it, in letting God write the story. And Minkai says that all the time. He said, there are two trails that you can walk. You can walk your own trail, or you can walk God's trail. But he says the difference is that when you get to the end of your trail, where are you? But if you walk God's trail, at the end of that trail, he has made a place for us to live with him happily forever. I think of it in terms of story. Life really is a story. And we can either write our own story, But there are hard chapters in our stories, and very often we end up at places that we just absolutely don't know what to do. I felt that when I was five and my dad was killed. It devastated my whole world. But I have learned in little steps that if we let God write the story, He doesn't promise that all the chapters will be easy, but He does promise that in the last chapter, if we let Him write the story, He will make sense of all the other chapters. I'm finding that to be true.
That's Steve Saint, son of martyred missionary Nate Saint, talking with Ralph Kurtenbach about his life and the movie End of the Spear. As World Radio continues, Ralph will next speak with a fellow HCJB missionary who acted in the movie and assisted in making it.
We're talking today with John Gowan about the End of the Spear, and John was a consultant to the producers and the director and an actor. Let's talk about your consultancy work first of all, John. What exactly were you consulted about? What kind of work did you do?
Okay, well, I worked on the team headed by the casting director, Mark Finn Cannon. What we did, and Mark doesn't do this on most films when he's hired as a casting director, but what we did as a team was to basically concern ourselves with anything having to do with the involvement of these Indians in the making of this film. None of these Indians had worked on a film before, and none of these filmmakers had had inexperienced Indians working on a film before. And so there was a big gap and all kinds of room for things to go wrong and to go sour, whether it was language barriers, health concerns, actual medical emergencies, negotiation of terms of the labor arrangements that they made with the tribal leadership, just the daily things of families and their parents having their kids on set, but then the parents having to work until 2 or 3 in the morning and the kids running around with nobody to take care of them. There was just a myriad of things that couldn't just be approached the way that a unionized standard movie-making approach would be.
There were no rules about this setup.
Or at least not all the rules applied all the time. And so my title is actually Intercultural Consultant, I think is what it was. But that's what it was just troubleshooting all of the hot spots that had come up that could, if not handled, could eventually jeopardize the making of the film, because the film depended very much on the participation of these Imbara Indian actors. Some of them play major roles in the film, and they're completely inexperienced. They've never done it before. It was really fun. We did acting workshops. We did scene preparation, not actually on set. The director did those. Now, the one thing I did directly with the director was when, after they were several days into shooting and he was catching so many complaints from the Imbara that they couldn't act their lines because the lines didn't make sense. And because they had been translated from English to Spanish and then Spanish to Imbara, but not by somebody who did movie dialogue translation professionally. And I've been doing that for several years. So I got asked to take the script back into the office, and we worked for several days, I don't remember exactly how many, reviewing all of the Indian dialogue and getting it so that it made sense in Imbara and that it actually reflected what the original English script intended for it to reflect.
Which then they had to say in the language...
Imbara.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were supposedly Waurani Indians, but the logistical concerns of trying to produce the film using Waurani Indians, although it was investigated and quite aggressively, but it was just impossible.
Okay.
So the decision was made to use this tribe in Panama to represent Waurani Indians from Ecuador.
Okay. What about you as Major Nuremberg? Do I have his name right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you bring to that? How much of a character is he?
Okay, well, just in terms of what I bring to it, I am professionally trained as an actor. I like to clarify that, because it wasn't just a matter of their thinking, hey, it'd be cool to put a missionary in there. I am a missionary too, but I'm a missionary actor. And as far as bringing to it, what I felt was some of what I've mentioned here is just the complexity of it, the questions, the unanswered questions. I mean, sure, we can go in and bring our military might to bear, to because we have helicopters and we have a ground party, so we can come in and provide a certain element of safety for people to come in and find the bodies and kind of figure out what happened. But why? The questions of why. My main scene that I'm in the movie is coming into the kitchen in the saint's home and telling the five widows what we found. They're all sitting there in the kitchen waiting for somebody to tell them. And I get to be the one. Mixed curse and blessing to do that. And we didn't do any particular rehearsing of the scene. It's just we came to the day of shooting and they gave us our costume and makeup. Just a very brief explanation from the director. And then I walk in and face these women.
I believe there's a still photograph by Cornell Kappa in Life magazine of that kitchen scene in Shell, Ecuador.
That's what the scene is based on, is that photo from Life magazine.
How about the wives? Was the emotion there?
Overwhelming. They're all professional actresses. And combining the job that they did in acting their parts with my knowledge of the families, and my closeness to a couple of the families, overwhelming is a good word to describe that event.
I'm talking today with John Gowan. We're talking about a story that happened in the Ecuadorian Amazon region in 1956, in which five missionary men were killed in their attempt to reach out with the love of Christ to a Stone Age tribe known then as the Aucas, more recently known as the Warani. All five were speared to death in that attempt. It was some time later that the wife, the widow of one of those men killed, and the sister of another who was killed, went back to that tribe with some contact beforehand with a gal by the name of Dayuma, who helped them in language acquisition and knowing the culture better.
It's also worth mentioning that Dayuma, who helped them with language training, that was her family that killed the missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a real providential thing, that the one who had come out and was already living outside was a family member of the group that killed the five missionaries and ended up going back in and taking the women in with her.
That's HCJB missionary John Gowan speaking with our very own Ralph Kurtenbach about the movie End of the Spear. And we want to let you know that next time on World Radio, we will also be focusing on the movie End of the Spear as Ralph talks to more people who were involved in making the movie and people whose lives were affected by the story in real life. That's next time on World Radio. Until then, I'm Eric Scadabo saying so long and God bless.
You have been listening to World Radio. World Radio is produced in the Melbourne studios of HCJB Australia with program input by HCJB World Radio International offices. We're always interested in your comments and questions. Our email address is english@hcjb.org.au and our mailing address is World Radio, HCJB Australia, GPO Box 691, Melbourne, 3001, Australia. Join us next time for another edition of World Radio.